From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. Good to have you with us today. As you just heard, a bit later, we're going to hear more about the newly formed Sheriff Civilian Oversight Commission. First, though, President Trump was tweeting again this morning, this time saying he'll make a decision on the Paris Climate Accord over the next few days. Now, that's the international agreement between nearly 200 countries to work together to reduce the causes and impacts of climate change. And now multiple outlets, including Politico and the New York Times, are reporting that the president is planning to withdraw. KPCC has not verified this independently, but backing out of the deal would mark a major shift for the U.S. and could defang the new agreement. Without the U.S. taking the lead, who will fill the gap and take up the fight against climate change? Might just be California. For more on how California's role could change if the U.S. does pull out, we turn to Kara Horowitz. She's co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Kara, welcome back to Take Two.
Hi, A.
Now, if the U.S. Does actually withdraw from the Paris Accord, what commitments would we be walking away from?
Well, the Paris Agreement is the first essentially universal climate agreement in which all countries pledge to take action to reduce their emissions. You know, not just developed countries, not just the U.S. and Europe, but all countries, including developing countries like China and India. The U.S. pledge under that agreement was to reduce its own emissions by about 26% below 2005 levels by the year 2025. So walking away from the Paris Agreement means walking away from that U.S. pledge. But I think more broadly than that, it also means walking away from engagement with the world community as the Paris Agreement is implemented. It means walking away from opportunities to keep pushing countries to do more under that agreement than they otherwise would.
Was it clear how we were going to do that 26%?
It was, I would say, partly clear. Okay. So the U.S. has a set of policies in place that would get us a lot of the way there, but we were going to have to do more work clearly over the next, you know, 8 or so years to fill the gap to get to the full amount of that pledge.
Now, Governor Jerry Brown has been really clear that fighting climate change is a big priority for California. And as it is, our state has led the nation on a number of fronts. Could a pullout allow California to take up the reins and work with domestic and international partners to maybe cobble together plans to reduce emissions?
Yeah, you know, California is actually already doing a lot of that work. And a lot of that work started in Paris, actually, when California sent a robust delegation to the city of Paris at the time that this Paris Agreement was first signed. It began at that time to construct this network, this coalition of subnational jurisdictions that was sort of parallel to the work that the national governments were doing in that city. So these are cities and provinces and states from all across the world coming together to make kind of similar parallel commitments to reduce their own emissions. California's been working on that network for years, and it's clear that that network becomes even more important now.
Kara, how would California suffer if the world doesn't get a handle on emissions?
Right. So why is California doing all of this in the first place? It's pretty clear that the leadership of California understands that climate change isn't just a kind of global, abstract problem. It has impacts that are local and real in California. So scientists tell us that our historic drought that we've been suffering through over the last 5 years, for example, was made much worse because of climate change. The wildfires that are ravaging our state seemingly every year are connected to climate change. We have a lot of coastline, a lot of very expensive coastline in California with lots of infrastructure that's at risk from sea level rise. Even in our cities, in our sort of urban cores, they'll get much hotter in a world of aggressive climate change, and that'll have public health impacts. There'll be more cases of asthma, there'll be more heat waves, more deaths of elderly and the vulnerable. So there's a lot at stake for California, and the state really understands that it's important to get a hold on the problem for those reasons that relate to local impacts.
We're talking about what would happen in California if the U.S. pulls out of the Paris Climate Accord. We're doing that with Kara Horowitz, co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. All right, Kara, now, there are three key areas where we could see California rise to the occasion if the U.S. indeed does pull out of the Paris Accord. Can you go over those with us?
Yeah, so I think that's right. I think there are sort of the top three things California could be doing and in some ways is already doing to help undergird the work of reducing climate emissions even without the Paris Agreement. And the first and most important is the work that it's doing to pioneer really ambitious climate policies at the state level. So California has one of the most ambitious statewide goals for reducing its climate emissions, and it has policies in place already that it has developed from scratch to help meet those goals. So it has a first-in-the-country cap-and-trade program, for example. It has clean car standards. So when you drive a car now in the United States, it's subject to an emission standard for greenhouse gas emissions that was developed first here in California. And it's doing so really explicitly to be a model for others so that others can come here and look at our policies and then adopt them back home if they want to. And so we've hosted, you know, delegates from Chinese provinces, for example, asking us how we run our cap and trade program so they can go home and essentially create one from scratch themselves. So that's the first way. The second way really relates to that international coalition work we were talking about, that under two coalition that California has been working on along with other, you know, partners and state provinces since the Paris Agreement was signed for a couple of years now. That under two coalition, again, becomes a lot more important in a world where we don't have the Paris Agreement.
Would it expand maybe, Kira?
I think it might. I mean, I think California is working to expand it regardless of whether we pull out. As it stands, the members of the under two coalition already represent, I think, more than a third of world GDP. These are provinces and states from Mexico and Canada and countries in Asia and Germany and France and Africa, really from all over the world. And so it continues to expand. And those countries share things like, you know, pathways to 2050 decarbonization and policy and analysis tools to track their GHG emissions. And most importantly, they share a goal. They share a goal of reducing their GHG emissions in a way that's consistent with keeping the world to under 2 degrees Celsius of warming.
And the last part, research and development, R&D.
Right. So I think one of the things we're really likely to lose at the federal level, whether or not the Trump administration pulls out of Paris, is robust funding for research and development to help us create kind of technological solutions to the problem of climate change. Those might be renewable energy breakthroughs or ways to store energy in batteries or other technologies that make the pathway to decarbonization, you know, much less expensive and much easier. And if we're not getting that R&D funding from the feds, I think it's possible that California may step up to the plate. It has the world's fifth or sixth largest economy if it were a country on its own. It certainly doesn't have the deep pockets of the feds, but it could do a lot to, you know, backstop that funding. And so I think it's possible California may decide to play that role too.
Kira Horowitz is the co-executive director of the Emmett Institute on Climate Change and the Environment at UCLA. Kira, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
Let's now take a look at environmental conditions here at home. Over the past several months, California amassed a record snowpack. But as temperatures rise and that snow melts, it's turning the state's rivers into more treacherous waters. Just last weekend, 3 people died and 24 more needed to be rescued at Kern River in central California. For advice on how to stay safe, we're joined by Mike Moeller, Battalion Chief for Cal Fire. Mike, welcome to Take Two.
Good morning, Nate. How are you, sir?
Good, Mike. Can you give us an idea of how much our rivers have changed because of snowmelt?
Sure.
Hold on 1 second, Mike. Let's see if we can get a better line there. We're talking to Mike Moeller, Battalion Chief for Cal Fire, talking about the differences with all of our rivers here in the state when it comes to the drought and the snowpack that we've gotten over the last few months. Mike, you there?
Can you hear me now?
I think we got you now. So give us an idea of how much our rivers have changed because of snowmelt.
Well, just like you mentioned, we've had several fatalities, unfortunately, there in the Central Valley, Northern California, but statewide. But what we're seeing now, after 6 years of drought, those rivers that people used to swim in not only are at record levels, but obstacles and hazards that used to be visible are no longer there. And even confident swimmers now are noticing that the currents are just so strong that the dangers have increased tenfold.
I didn't think of obstacles that aren't there anymore. I completely forgot about that. Now, I'm wondering, is this true about rivers all over the state or just maybe Kern and a few other ones?
No, all over the state, we're seeing waterways, you know, as water moves into from Northern California to Central and Southern California, we're seeing an increase in volume statewide. And that's where we're seeing these emergencies, and not only where we've seen the fatalities, but an increase in water rescues, unfortunately.
Mike, did the drought of the last few years make us, I guess, forget about how dangerous some of these rivers can be?
That's a great point. It has. And like I said, even if you thought you were a competent swimmer, what we've become is complacent because these rivers have been so low that the flow rates have slowed down. So now when people are going out there, what they visited last year at the same time to this year is completely different, with flow rates that have increased. Again, the obstacles that used to be visible are no longer there. And some areas that you used to be able to swim safely are no longer accessible, and people are still trying to get to them.
Why do you think that is, Mike? Because, I mean, it's not like the drought has lasted hundreds of years, or at least we haven't been around that long. It's only been a few years, and we forget that fast.
Well, and you know, we do. And what we're seeing also, too, is an increase in public that's not used to staying on the waterways. Now they see beautiful rivers flowing, and maybe it may not be foreign to them. They may not have been to them that often, but now they're frequenting them. And so we're getting some public from the inland area that are going to the rivers that aren't familiar or not have the swimming expertise to be in these type of waterways.
All right, so Mike, if people want to enjoy the waters, what are some precautions they should take this year?
You know, not only Cal Fire, but our state, local, federal partners, but is my recommendation is the first thing is you have what's called a water watcher. That's part of your group, that only person's like a family lifeguard, that all they do is keep the eye on the water. They're not in the water. If they have family members, especially small children, that you assign a watcher. Number two, life vests. You have to have your, especially small children, but if you're within 10 feet of a waterway that's moving, a stream or a river, you should have a life vest on also, just in case, not only for your safety, but if somebody should fall in. And then again, if there's a lifeguard on duty or a lifeguard tower, check in with them. Ask them, you know, where is the best place to swim? Where should we be? How do I keep safe and my family safe?
All right, Mike Moeller, Battalion Chief for Cal Fire. Mike, thanks for the advice.
Thanks, A. We appreciate it.
We hear a lot of stories about homeless veterans, but we rarely hear about women veterans who find themselves living on the streets. It's an invisible population that is growing in need. Here's the thing, though. There aren't many organizations set up to help female veterans get back on their feet and find homes. One place, though, is trying. Rebecca Shear has a story, and just a warning, there is some strong language in this story.
The federal government estimates that on any given night, 3,000 to 4,000 female veterans are homeless. But that estimate's probably on the low side, says Sarah Scocco, who directs the women's program of the nonprofit group Soldier On.
When people are doing homeless counts, they're going to shelters. They're seeing people on the street. A female veteran is not the person you see on the street holding a sign.
She might be a single mom. She may have experienced sexual trauma. So, says Scocco, these women are holing up in their cars. They're couch surfing. As a result,
the issue of female veteran homelessness is so underlooked, understudied. It's not understood because it's not in your face all the time.
So Soldier On decided to do its part
by
building a transitional housing facility just for women.
So welcome to the women's program.
In this bright and airy three-story building on the VA campus in Leeds, Massachusetts, the program houses 16 women and caters to their special needs with things like art and yoga classes, support groups, and job counseling.
A lot of women that come to us have really lost everything. They've lost all sense of hope. And so all of what we do is build them back up.
Scocco says all the residents suffered some sort of trauma before, during, or after they served. 61-year-old Luann Hazelwood, who was in the Army in the 1970s and 80s, says her verbal, physical, and sexual trauma started early in life.
I more or less wanted to join the military as a way of escape.
But she experienced more trauma in the military after she got out, too. When she came to the women's program, she was fleeing her second abusive marriage and was so traumatized she didn't speak. Being only around women made her feel safer.
I can't say I've ever really had a positive relationship with a man. And, you know, I have yet to totally trust being around a man. So for me, it was a way of recouping from all the abuse that I went through.
33-year-old Paige is another resident of the program. The former Air Force technician asked that we not use her last name. She'd struggled with depression and self-esteem issues long before she enlisted. She thought being in the military might help.
I was thinking I was going to get some sort of approval and pat on the back.
Instead, Paige got verbally harassed.
You know, you're called a whore, fat bitch.
And she fell into a culture of drinking.
You party a lot. That's what happens. You work hard, you play hard.
And Paige played especially hard.
I remember going through Walmart after work one day. This is when I was drinking, and I wanted to crawl under a rock and, like, die. Because a lady stopped with her daughter and pointed to me and said, "See, honey, that's a hero. Like, I'm supposed to be here protecting you. If I can't even help myself, what the hell am I doing?"
Paige confided in a therapist. She says he threatened to have her thrown out. In the end, she was allowed to resign with an honorable discharge. After rotating through several co-ed detox programs for veterans, she found the women's program. Were you still drinking at that point?
Mm-hmm. I stopped, I think, like, the day or day before that I came in here. And I haven't had a drink since.
By 2020, the number of female veterans is expected to reach 2.2 million. So there's an intense need for more gender-specific services, says Director Sarah Skoko.
There are women that have served the hell out of our country, and they're not being recognized, and they need to be. They need to be treated, not the same way as males, but they need to be treated, period.
But demand for women-only services vastly exceeds supply. For these 16 rooms in Massachusetts, the women's program often has a waiting list and has received referrals and applications from as far away as Hawaii. I'm Rebecca Shear in Leeds, Massachusetts.
Now to a story about Syrian refugees in California. Most live in resettlement areas, San Diego and Turlock, for example, cities that get federal funding to help these newcomers start over. But some Syrians are now migrating on their own to Fresno, where there's cheaper housing and a large Arab American community. As Alice Daniel reports, volunteers and advocacy groups are scrambling to keep up.
Naam? Kif yani?
Layla Darwish looks up from the sidewalk and greets a Syrian woman yelling down to her from her second-floor apartment. Darwish just saw her yesterday, but...
She said, "I haven't seen you in a long time," so that's quite common. A lot of them are kind of territorial. They want you to spend more time with them.
And Darwish, a Palestinian-American, does. She has a part-time job with FIRM, or Fresno Interdenominational Refugee Ministries, to help Syrians interpret their new landscape. But for Darwish, part-time means all her waking hours. In addition to her work, she started a tutoring program where volunteers help kids with homework. About half of Syrian refugees are children. In this 16-unit apartment complex, there are 41 kids. Some of them are chasing each other in the courtyard. 22-year-old Ray Harris is part of the only family here that's not Syrian. He says he likes his neighbors.
They show a lot of love, man. They bring you food and everything.
Next door to Harris, Mohammed Bashan tells Darwish life is better for refugees here in America. But when he and his family first moved to Fresno, they were scared. Darwish explains.
Because they didn't know where to start or where to begin. And in the beginning, there was a local mosque that helped them just network with people. And then once FIRM came in, we started taking them to the DMV to get their permits, their driving lessons.
A few decades ago, this neighborhood was teeming with Hmong refugees. The rents are still cheap, about $450 for a two-bedroom unit, but it isn't always safe.
There have been a number of attacks from the neighborhood gangs, from anywhere from throwing stones, knives. The police have been called lately.
FIRM director Zach Dara says he's partnering with local Islamic cultural centers, churches, and advocacy groups to help Syrians find better housing, cars, and jobs. About 200 Syrians have migrated to Fresno, most in the past year, and Dara expects more.
I've gotten calls from Indiana, from Florida, from Texas, San Diego, San Jose.
Fresno is used to having refugees. Hmong and other groups make up about 10% of the city's population. But helping refugees is tricky without resettlement funds, says Dara.
The dollars are very challenging, you know, and it's also because it's a polarizing issue. I've spoken at places that blatantly do not agree with the work that we're doing.
But plenty do. Take Kathleen Shavor-Bergen. She's part of Fresno's large Armenian community, and she's been helping out because her grandparents were genocide survivors who found safety in Aleppo, Syria.
It's really the least I can do. They opened their arms to my family, and now I'm opening my arms to theirs.
There's been enough of a migration here that the International Rescue Committee was considering Fresno as a future resettlement city. But that was before President Trump's travel ban put the refugee program on hold.
That was Alice Daniel with the California Report. All right, last week, the Sheriff's Civilian Oversight Commission renewed efforts to be more transparent about incidents involving discipline and the use of force. The resolution was passed unanimously by the newly formed 9-member commission. Some of the recommendations include publishing the number of times deputies are disciplined, listing the kinds of actions that warrant discipline, and other actions as well. Now, yesterday, the union that represents rank-and-file deputies said that they would like even more information to become available. Joining us now is KPCC reporter Frank Stoltz. Hello, Frank.
Hey.
All right. Can you first tell us what the Sheriff's Civilian Oversight Commission wants?
Well, the commission is demanding, and I say demanding, it has limited authority over the sheriff. The sheriff's independently elected. So it's really requesting that the sheriff release a lot more data, as you mentioned, data that reflects the total number of deputies and other sheriff's officials involved in shootings and other uses of force and how and whether they are disciplined. Composite information regarding civilian complaints against the LASD in terms of types of complaints and the disposition of those complaints. So a wide range of data. And this follows an Inspector General's report more than a year ago that found that the Sheriff's Department releases less data than other major police departments.
And what do the unions say to this? They want more specific information reports.
Well, what's really interesting is that the union that represents the some 8,000-9,000 sheriff's deputies last year blocked the sheriff's department from releasing information about deputies who shoot because and discipline, citing state law that says, you know, this is personnel data that's protected. And so now they're saying, look, if you're going to release information about shootings in the aggregate, you're not going to name the individual sheriff's department, but you're going to say, you know, X number of officers, deputies shot, X number were disciplined in this fashion, then you ought to also release data about how many times deputies could have lawfully used force but refrained from doing so.
How do you do that, though?
Well, it's a tough one because these things are judged in hindsight, right? So, could I have used force then or not? I think this is as much about the deputies union trying to say, look, you know, there are a lot of times that we refrain from using force, that we de-escalate, and we're not really getting credit for that.
Now, Max Huntsman, the department's inspector general, said he supports sharing more information, but said that that type of information isn't available across the department. Tell us about that.
Well, you mean the type of information where they could have used force but didn't?
Yeah.
Well, again, it's not data that they're currently collecting. But, you know, I always think of a story I heard from one cop over at the LAPD who said he came upon a guy in the Rampart Division. He had worked this division for a long time. He knew this guy. He knew this guy not to be a violent person, but he was a drug dealer. And he went to arrest him, and the guy pulled a gun. And he hesitated shooting because he knew the guy. And, in fact, the guy was carrying a BB gun. And the suspect said, look, I'm sorry I pulled the gun on you, to the cop. And it was a case where clearly the officer could have used force, could have shot him because he was faced with a man with a gun. And he stopped. And so there are these cases, you know, where they certainly could use deadly force, and they don't. And it's data that's not being collected. And again, I think the deputies union and officers in general are frustrated by the current debate where most of the focus is on, you know, where they are shooting and certainly cases where they should have not fired. And they want to say, look, you know, there are a lot of cases where we are withholding fire.
Now, Frank, we got about a minute here, but while I got you here, I want to ask you about an Inglewood shooting last year. Police there shot a man and a woman who were found unconscious in their car. Remember this story? There was a lot of public outcry about this. Now the city's mayor says police officers involved are no longer with the department. What happened there?
I think the main thing to say here, A, is that, five Inglewood police officers have left the department following this shooting. They were involved in this shooting. I think all of them actually fired their weapons. And this is an extraordinary number of police officers to leave a department around one incident. So something's going on here. The frustration for journalists and the family is that the department has not provided a full explanation on why exactly these officers fired. The investigation continues at the DA's office, so I think more will be revealed around this one.
All right, that's KPCC's Frank Stoltz. Frank, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
More Take Two coming right up. Stay tuned. Back now with Take Two. I'm A. Martinez. June is Pride Month. In the coming weeks, LGBT people across the world will celebrate with parties and festivals. But at LA's upcoming parade, the tone is shifting from pride to protest. And that's because of the election of Donald Trump. KPCC's Leo Duran reports.
Earlier this year was the 50th anniversary of the Black Cat Tavern protest in LA. It was one of America's first major LGBT demonstrations, even before the riot at New York's Stonewall Inn. It was against the police treatment of LGBT folks, and people paid their respects by recreating that march.
What do we want?
Justice!
It was that very night that Brian Pendleton announced that he wanted to turn LA's Pride Parade into a serious protest like the Black Hat March. His idea went viral, and he's now the organizer of what's become LA's Resist March.
So we've converted the parade, you know, floats and fun, to a march for civil rights.
It's happening on Sunday, June 11th. Instead of staying within the boundaries of West Hollywood, like parades in past years, it's starting off in Hollywood at Hollywood and Highland.
It's where the Oscars happen now, and serendipitously, that's where LA Pride was born in 1970.
That was also a protest march. This upcoming one will continue into West Hollywood, ending at the LA Pride Festival grounds. It's in coordination with protests in more than 50 cities around the world. They're all taking place under the banner Equality March for Unity and Pride. Annika Simpson is co-organizing the international effort.
You have the Science March, the Climate March, the Women's March, Immigration March. I feel a sense of solidarity across these groups.
And Pendleton thinks this upcoming one takes the baton from those past events.
We're lending our gigantic, iconic rainbow flag, not just to the LGBTQ community, but to anyone who feels threatened.
But some people are raining on this protest. Major sponsors who supported the LA Pride Parade in the past have bailed on the Resist March, like Nissan and Sky Vodka. Wells Fargo was a longtime one too, and a spokesman says it would have backed a parade, but as a policy, it won't sponsor political or partisan rallies like this one. Pendleton says he's okay with it.
I think people would find that rather dubious and wonder if their messaging has been co-opted by corporate America.
For me, it's not about these corporations usurping our movement.
That's trans woman Drian Juarez, who agrees with the sentiment. And she was increasingly uncomfortable with sponsorships at past Pride festivals.
Last year, I was at one of the events at the Latin stage, but the stage was called the Fox Stage. As in, I believe, Fox Media, Fox TV. And so for me, the Resist March is really about coming back to our roots.
Then there are others who are resisting the Resist March because they're conservative.
I mean, it's just very disappointing to me.
This is Matthew Craffey. He heads the LA chapter of the Log Cabin Republicans, an LGBT group. And he doesn't want to lose the Pride Parade.
I feel like this is the one weekend a year where we really can all put the politics aside.
March organizers say the event isn't partisan, but Craffey says people like him probably wouldn't be welcomed.
I know it will be anti-Republican. Like, there's no doubt in my mind it's going to be anti-Republican. So to me, there is a target. And if you look at the fact that resist marches across the country have a pretty focused target, and that is the Trump administration.
And he argues Trump himself has not done anything to roll back LGBT rights.
There's been a lot of panic about what President Trump might do. Like, I would just say this. We still have the right to marry. We still have all the rights that when he came into office, we had.
Others want to know exactly what they're meant to resist. Oliver El Puche owns Redline, a gay bar in downtown LA. He leans more liberal, but he wants more specifics from march organizers about what he should be protesting against.
What are the points that is going to resonate with the entire LGBT community to say this is what we stand for and this is why we're basically giving up the Pride Parade?
And El Puche says organizers aren't clear about what he should do when the march ends.
Doing a march and ending up at the Pride Festival, is it to get all the people just filtered down and go to the festival? If no one knows what to do afterwards, the next day people are just going to move on to the next topic of conversation. When do we stop becoming activists and when do we start becoming leaders?
But the leader of LA's Resist March, Brian Pendleton, says the event is the first step in taking a page from LGBT history to face the future of American politics.
And this idea that we're getting back to our roots as a protest organization rather than as a parading organization, it felt right.
So Pendleton hopes that when people participate in a march to resist, they can walk away proud. I'm Leo Duran.
In what is now an annual tradition, the Cleveland Cavaliers and the Golden State Warriors will play for the NBA championship tomorrow. The two teams will meet in the finals again, like they have over three straight seasons. It's what most basketball fans thought would happen and maybe even wanted to happen, right?
Can you dig it?
Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the jello is jiggling.
In a year that has been so improbable, the impossible has happened.
All right, one thing I know everyone wants every Wednesday, that's Andy and Brian Kamenetsky.
Hello, eh?
Hello, hi, you two. Eh? Two most wanted sports brothers in the world.
Neither improbable nor impossible, there I like you go. To think of us.
All right, so Warriors-Cavs Part 3. Andy, was there ever a doubt this was going to happen again?
Well, considering these teams have lost a combined one game during the playoffs, it would seem like this always felt like a fate locked in stone. I will say, to a certain extent, there was a little bit of doubt in the regular season. I mean, short of a catastrophic injury or two, the Golden State Warriors in the finals was fait accompli. They have four all-star or better caliber players and tons of experience. But the Cleveland Cavaliers looked a little bit more vulnerable in the second half of the season. Their record in March and April was 10-14. Their defense was often atrocious. The team seemed concerned, and it also became fair to wonder if fatigue was catching up to LeBron James. This is now his seventh straight finals appearance, dating back to 2011. LeBron's logged heavy minutes, and at some point, everybody hits the wall. Cleveland was still considered the favorite to win the Eastern Conference, but then they just looked more vulnerable than ever before. But once the playoffs began, the script flipped. You get more rest between games. You also started seeing a fair amount of lopsided results, which offers the Cavaliers even more rest during the fourth quarter. And then Warriors-Cavaliers, it was a destiny that just readily apparent.
So, Brian, what does this year-long deja vu mean for the rest of the league? Did anyone care about the NBA season? I mean, because I was playing fantasy basketball, so I cared, but I don't know if anybody else did.
I also was playing fantasy basketball and therefore cared. But the short answer is, yeah, people cared. I mean, the NBA announced in April that nearly 22 million people attended games this season. That is the third straight season in which they've set a league-wide attendance record. In the regular season, you might say, oh, there's a couple danger signs on television. The national broadcasts for games of the NBA's partner networks, that's ABC, ESPN, TNT, and NBA TV, they were down slightly, about 6% from last year. But they were even with the year before, and some of that dip can be attributed to the fact that they were actually broadcasting more games. There were 20 more games this year, including Monday nights, and people just aren't used to watching national televised games on Mondays. When you kind of, and then you factor in a rise in streaming on ESPN, which was up sharply, when you sort of normalize for all that other stuff,
basically the same amount of people were watching this year as the year before, despite knowing what the end of the movie was going to look like. The only place where there might be some danger signs is with local television ratings. According to the Sports Business Journal, 20 regional sports networks this year saw a ratings decline for NBA games, and 15 of those by double digits. Some of that they blame on the election. People were a little preoccupied near the beginning of the season.
They? And that's not important.
You know, ratings for all sports were really bad during September, October, November. So that's part of it. But and streaming is having an impact on local TV ratings. But there are at least some signs that the sort of regional sports network makeup, you know, like Spectrum Sportsnet that we have in LA that shows the Lakers games, or Fox Sports West, which shows the Clippers games, that those organizations are losing some strength, even as the NBA clearly isn't.
Now, Andy, one of the things that I have seen social media reaction is that some people don't like that there's two powerhouse teams going up against each other for three straight years. And for me, it brings back memories of my childhood. In the 80s, there was a stretch, a nine-year stretch, where the Lakers or the Celtics won the championship 8 out of 9 years. Unless I'm forgetting things, and I am older, so maybe I am, that was considered a great era in the NBA.
You look good for your age.
I know.
Though,
I am holding up well. I know that. I look in the mirror every day. That was a great...
Keep up the prescription.
That was a great time in the NBA. So what's wrong with two super teams going at it?
Well, in theory, there's absolutely nothing wrong with this. It's exactly what sports fans want. We love repeat champions. We love dynasties. We love rivalries. You know,
yes.
Beyond Showtime and the Celtics, what do we always celebrate about Michael Jordan's Bulls? That they were able to three-peat on two separate occasions.
They would have probably won it all the way through.
Right. We remember the Kobe-Shaq Lakers that went back-to-back-to-back, or the Kobe-Pau Gasol Lakers that won consecutive championships.
People watch the Patriots on TV. Golf was never more popular than when Tiger Woods was dominated. We love dominance.
Exactly. The problem isn't the end result. It's the path getting there. As I said earlier, the Cavaliers and Warriors lost one combined game in the finals, and there weren't a lot of white-knuckle games in the process. There were a lot of blowouts, a lot of very lopsided games from start to finish. And even worse, the losing teams, which were at a disadvantage to begin with, continually suffered significant injuries, most notably Kawhi Leonard and Tony Parker for the Spurs going against the Warriors, or Isaiah Thomas going up against the Cavaliers.
Yeah, those injuries suck the drama
right,
out of
exactly.
Those games.
They made each result for the series feel even more anticlimactic. And it also, too, I think these games fed the narrative that super teams are ruining the NBA. This wave we've seen in the last 10 or so years of star players teaming up with each other to form these super teams with three or four stars. And also, too, it feels really specifically like a referendum on Kevin Durant, who's now with the Golden State Warriors. He's a top three player at absolute worst. He's a former MVP, and he joined the Warriors after leaving the Oklahoma City Thunder.
After getting beat by them.
Right. And they played the Warriors in the Western Conference Finals and played them pretty well.
Last season, yeah.
And I think in the eyes of a lot of sports fans, Kevin Durant took the easy way out, joined the Warriors, but more importantly, he helped continually upset the balance of power in the NBA, where basically only one or two teams have any shot whatsoever of getting to the
and
finals.
And it's interesting about a couple of things that Andy said. First of all, if we as basketball people, and Andy and I are certainly basketball people, we watch this stuff
very
closely.
You go to practices.
We go to practice.
Yeah,
we love the game. We love the NBA. Ratings were up for the NBA play. Ratings have been great for the playoffs this year. So people love watching the Cavaliers and the Warriors beat up on teams. The league certainly, I think, is trying to create a situation where players like Kevin Durant can't, you know, makes it harder for players like Durant to form these super teams and stuff to try to get a little bit more competitive balance across the league. So certainly the rules are constantly being reshaped and rewritten to make it easier for players, particularly small market teams like the Oklahoma City Thunder, for example, where Kevin Durant left, to hold on to their own team, their best players. But the weird thing is, to me, find me another industry where a guy like Kevin Durant has the opportunity to decide where he's going to work, and he's supposed to stay in the place that is less fun, where his professional success won't be as high, where he may not enjoy going to work as much, because the rest of us demand that his path
weird,
be harder. Like,
strange.
You know, that's just not how
it's also too. It's
work
important.
Is supposed to work.
It's important to remember that, you know, Magic Johnson, for example, never
never jumped to another team or joined up with Larry Bird or another, you know, iconic Hall of Fame caliber peer, because he never had to.
He had him already.
Magic Johnson played on a team with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, James Worthy, Byron Scott, Michael Cooper, you know, Larry Bird played on a stacked team.
Three of those guys are in the NBA's top 50 of all time.
Michael Jordan played on stacked teams. There's a reason that a lot of these players never had to team up with somebody else. They already had all the guys.
All right, so all in all, Cavs, Warriors, Part 3, this is going to make some great television.
This is going to be a massive, massive television event. And so I think it's a lot like a Super Bowl, where it's going to draw in a lot of casual fans. People are going to be talking about what's going on in the series, because you have LeBron James, who, if he wins this series against a heavily favored Warriors team, you really do start the conversation about whether or not he's overtaken Michael Jordan as the greatest player of all time. You have Kevin Durant, who's trying very hard to win his first title. There are so many storylines here. They're the two teams that everybody knows. They're two of the three or four or five best players in the NBA. Big TV. Big TVA.
All right. Big radio here. Andy and Brian Kamenetsky. We'll talk to you guys next week.
Thank you.
A new bill on the way to the California Senate would require pet stores that sell dogs and cats to only offer those obtained from a shelter or other nonprofits. The legislation, which passed the Assembly Tuesday, takes aim at puppy mills and other large breeding operations. Assemblyman Patrick O'Donnell of Long Beach sponsored the bill, and he joins us now. Assemblyman O'Donnell, good to talk to you.
Good morning, eh? Thank you for the invitation.
Sure. Now, what do you hope to achieve with this bill?
Well, AB 485, Assembly Bill 485, requires all dogs, cats, and rabbits offered for retail sale in California pet stores to be obtained by an animal shelter, to be obtained from an animal shelter or a nonprofit rescue organization. The ultimate goal being to save animal lives and save taxpayers' dollars.
Now, this law, or a law like this, already exists in some 33 cities. So what's the real need for statewide legislation?
Well, what we desire to do is create one statewide consistent policy, so that California has one policy instead of a patchwork of policies across our state.
Now, you mentioned that it'll save taxpayer dollars. How so?
Very simply, California spends about $250 million a year to capture and house animals that have walked away from their homes or have been given up, and then ultimately those are often euthanized. And again, we spent about $250 million on that effort. And if our pet stores were to sell those rescue animals in their own retail establishments, that would allow for a great savings in taxpayer dollars across our state.
Now let's get to those pet stores. We're not talking about Petcos of the world, right? We're talking about smaller shops.
Yeah, small shops. Petco and PetSmart, and in fact, many other retail establishments across the state already have adopted this best business practice, as I call it, of ensuring that the animals that are for sale in a retail establishment come from a nonprofit or a rescue organization.
Now, the Pet Industry Joint Advisory Council, which includes chains like Petco, opposes this bill. Here's a statement from President Mike Bober.
Banning non-rescue, non-shelter pet sales of cats, rabbits, and dogs could close pet stores across the state. This is going to simultaneously put hundreds of people out of work and reduce the state's protections for prospective pet owners. Pet stores are the most highly regulated source for these companion animals in the state right now, and unfortunately those protections would be jeopardized by this.
Assemblyman O'Donnell, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I absolutely disagree with all of his points. In fact, not only 10% of our registered pet stores in California sell dogs, cats, or rabbits. So again, we're talking about a minority of pet stores in California that would have to alter their business practice. And in fact, at our hearing, we had pet stores come in and testify and say they've already adopted this practice and it's working for them. They're making money and they've shown that this practice works and it works well, and it allows them to ensures their business a profit as well.
Now, you say alter their practices, but wouldn't it be for some completely changing it 180 degrees?
You can label it whatever you want, but I think the ultimate goal is to stop the puppy mills that are breeding animals, thousands of them in the Midwest, and then shipping them to California for sale and for profit, wherein at the same time we have thousands of animals sitting in shelters that go without a loving home.
Now, don't most people already get their dogs and cats from shelters or private breeders? I mean, do you know how many people actually get their pets from puppy window type pet stores?
Not many, but yet we still know that there are many pets sitting in retail establishments, again, that have been shipped from out of state. So what we want to do is we want to cut that off and find our pets sitting, our animals sitting in rescue and shelters, homes, loving homes. And in fact, and understand that to me, this isn't just political, this is personal. I have two rescue dogs in my own home that are part of our family.
Now, how do you hope that this bill helps reduce puppy mills and maybe even abusive breeding practices?
Well, what I think it'll do is it will shut off that out-of-state supply that often come from puppy mills in the Midwest that are unhealthy, often are unhealthy and unsanitary places. And so I see this as benefiting all of California. It saves animal lives and it saves the taxpayers' dollars.
It wouldn't stop it necessarily. I mean, that would still go on, but how would that come back to California?
Well, it wouldn't. Those animals shipped in would not be allowed to be sold in retail establishments.
Okay.
And again, this doesn't affect the breeder because if you have a passion about a breed, typically you're already going to a breeder that too has a passion for that breed. A quality and respected breeder will not sell to a pet store already.
Now, what kind of reaction have you gotten for this bill? What kind of support have you gotten?
It's been bipartisan. We had 54 votes off the assembly floor yesterday. We had Republicans stand up and speak in support of the bill. We had Democrats stand up and speak in support of the bill because I think they see the overall benefits to the state of creating a consistent policy and saving the taxpayers' dollars.
All right. Assemblyman Patrick O'Donnell sponsored Bill AB 485, which passed in the state's assembly yesterday. Assemblyman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. May dog be with you.
All right, coming up in just a few minutes at 10 o'clock, it's Air Talk with Larry Mal. Hello, Larry.
Hi, hey, good morning. Coming up, we're going to take a look at yesterday's successful missile defense system test out of Vandenberg Air Force Base, just north of Santa Barbara. The system has a lot of challenges to shoot down any sort of intercontinental ballistic missile that might be headed our way. But we're going to talk about what the successful test means and how much more work there is to go.
It kind of reminds of the Reagan-era Star Wars thing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Same principle, yeah. Except they're not shooting rays at the incoming
yes.
missile. We're also going to be talking about the gubernatorial race. Antonio Villaraigosa, former mayor of L.A., will be here to talk about his candidacy for governor. So he'll be with us.
All right. That's Air Talk with Larry Mantle coming up at 10 o'clock. Thanks,
Great.
Larry.
Thanks, hey.
All right, we love to get your tweets, either mean ones or nice ones. We love them and read them anyway. So find us at Take Two. That's at Take Two. And while you're there, why don't you follow me as well, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. This is Take Two. I'm AMartinez.